Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Like, they'll see ice around. A lot of panic has been already spreading around the community.
Federal agents launch an immigration sweep in New Orleans, the latest city to see enforcement escalate under President Trump.
For Wednesday, December 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Tomorrow, an advisory committee to the CDC meets to consider changing vaccine recommendations for kids.
We've already now started a pretty steep decline in vaccine acceptance in the United States.
Plus, will next year's midterms be fair?
Across the country, election officials are already preparing for the possibility of interference by the Trump administration.
I think we're all kind of conditioned at this point to expect anything and everything, and our bingo cards keep getting bigger and bigger.
Plus, remembering playwright Tom Stoppard.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. For the second day in a row, President Trump denigrated Somali immigrants and the entire nation of Somalia. NPR's Mara Liasson reports those remarks got more personal today.
In the past, President Trump has often attacked Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, an American citizen who emigrated to the U.S. from Somalia as a child. But his recent comments have been harsh, even by Trump's standards. On Tuesday, he called Omar garbage, and now he says she should not be allowed to be a congresswoman.
I'm sure people are looking at that. And she should be thrown the hell out of our country.
Trump also attacked Somalia itself, saying it isn't even a nation. It's just a people walking around killing each other. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
50 years ago, Congress passed and President Gerald Ford signed the landmark law that created special education as we know it. NPR's Corey Turner reports on the impact of the Individuals with Disabilities Act, or IDEA.
In 1970, public schools educated just one in five children with a disability. Ed Martin, now 94, helped write the law that changed that.
There was one mother who told us a story about the school bus stopping at the foot of her driveway and her daughter standing in the window crying, saying, "Why can't I go with the other kids?"
IDEA requires schools to provide accommodations for kids with disabilities. The Trump administration has made cuts at the Department of Education, including staff who oversee IDEA, saying it wants to end bureaucracy and empower states. But critics warn federal oversight is an important safeguard for families who depend on the landmark law. Corey Turner, NPR News.
A doctor who supplied the drug ketamine to actor Matthew Perry in the weeks before his death has been sentenced to prison in Los Angeles. Steve Futterman reports.
Dr. Salvador Plasencia was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison, the judge accusing him of putting Matthew Perry on the road that eventually killed him. Before the sentencing, the court heard emotional statements from Perry's family. His mother, Suzanne Morrison, told Plasencia, "I want you to see his mother." She accused him of putting aside his oath to protect people in order to make money. When it was his turn to speak, Plasencia turned to address Perry's family and said, "I should have protected him." Plasencia, who pleaded guilty in July, was immediately taken into custody. Other defendants in the case are set to be sentenced in the next few weeks. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at the Federal Courthouse in Los Angeles.
Tech billionaire Jared Isaacman is again being considered for NASA's top job. He was removed from consideration and then re-nominated by President Trump. He appeared before the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee today as NASA prepares to send astronauts back to the moon. You are listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. San Francisco officials say a pilot program that loosened vehicle restrictions on Market Street to allow robo-taxis and ride-hail vehicles is moving forward. Currently, the city is allowing Waymo, Lyft, and Uber to use some loading bays. The pilot's next phase, later this month, will lift limits on the hours and the number of vehicles they can operate. Transit and pedestrian advocacy groups say it's a move in the wrong direction. Here's Christopher White with the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition.
We've consistently heard about and witnessed more private vehicles illegally driving on Market Street since the experiment began. And who can blame them when, to all appearances, Market Street is back open to cars?
Business groups support the move, which they hope will help revitalize the downtown area. Oakland's police department is paying millions in salaries and benefits to officers who are out on administrative leave pending investigation amid a budget and staffing crisis. San Francisco Chronicle reporter David Hernandez says OPD is more than 200 officers short of what it needs and has 29 officers on leave, 15 of them for more than a year. Hernandez calls it a vicious cycle.
You're already short-staffed. You have some officers who are on leave, and you can't get through their investigations quick enough because you are short-staffed and you don't have enough investigators to handle their cases. And it still begs the question, though, about why the department isn't prioritizing administrative investigations of officers more.
Hernandez says some relief is coming with around 50 recruits set to graduate from the police academy early next year. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org and from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Cover Up from Citizen 4 director Laura Poitras. With access to notes from reporter Seymour Hirsch, this documentary captures the process and power of investigative journalism. On Netflix, December 26th, awards eligible.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Federal agents launched a long-expected immigration enforcement sweep today in New Orleans. It's the latest metro area targeted by the Trump administration's campaign to step up arrests and deportations of immigrants in the country without legal status. NPR's Martin Costi is in New Orleans. We're going to join him for the latest. Hey, Martin.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So we have seen these kind of immigration enforcement sweeps in other Democratic-run cities this year. I'm thinking of L.A., of Chicago, of Charlotte. Are we looking for the same type of operation in New Orleans?
Well, so far the feds are promising something similar here. They say they're going after people who are in the country illegally and have committed crimes. And in New Orleans, they say that means looking for people with criminal histories who are let out of a local jail but not turned over to ICE. That's what the feds want local jails to do, turn those people over if they're in the country illegally. Trump has been highly critical of what he calls sanctuary policies, which he says protects criminals from being deported. But all that said, this operation probably won't focus only on criminals, because what we've seen in other operations, such as in Chicago, is that most of the people who were swept up on immigration violations did not have criminal records.
And you're there. What are you seeing so far? This is day one of an operation that's expected to go, what, for weeks? Yeah.
Probably, yeah. Well, we're getting scattered reports from volunteer spotters with immigration advocacy groups who say they've seen immigration agents at places like Home Depot and Lowe's, the same kinds of businesses that were targets in Los Angeles earlier this year. But what's more noticeable in this city, I really should say, is these scattered closures of some smaller sort of mom-and-pop restaurants and some bars that have temporarily shut their doors or maybe reduced their hours. Some people say it's because they don't have enough workers showing up, but others say in some cases it's preemptive to avoid a raid.
Bars closing in New Orleans, no small thing. I'm also recalling all of the pushback against ICE in other cities, thinking of Chicago in particular. What kind of reaction could ICE expect there in Louisiana?
There seems to be a difference between New Orleans proper and the suburbs on this. For instance, there's a suburb called Kenner, which saw a big increase in Latino residents in the last few years. There, the city and the police chief have welcomed ICE, and Latinos in the community say they're getting a similar vibe from some of their non-immigrant neighbors. I talked to a man named Jesse Bermudez earlier today. He runs a Latin American grocery store. I should say that store was completely empty, and he says that's really typical right now. People just aren't coming out. But he told me that a lot of the people in that neighborhood came here to help rebuild New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and now he says, at least on social media, they're being told it's time to go.
I'll see on the comments saying, you have a lot of people. It's good that they leave. It's, you know, they're not supposed to be here and whatnot, but one of y'all probably called to get a roof fixed, or one of y'all probably called to get a door fixed, or, you know, replace something. So it's really a distasteful feeling that just seeing people, our own community, turning their backs on someone that really helped out.
Martin, you've been sharing some of the reaction in the suburbs. What about in New Orleans itself, the city, which is so dependent on tourists?
Very much so, and Mardi Gras is coming. As we mentioned, New Orleans police aren't supposed to help with immigration enforcement. The police superintendent, Ann Kirkpatrick, calls immigration a civil matter. It's not her responsibility. But I'll say officials here are under a lot of pressure from the state, from Republican Governor Jeff Landry and the legislature, because they want to see local law enforcement cooperating with the feds. So unlike Chicago or L.A., which were backed by their state sanctuary policies, New Orleans really is kind of alone. It's on its own on this.
NPR's Martin Costi reporting from New Orleans. Thank you, Martin.
You're welcome.
Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth is on the hot seat again. Yesterday, he faced scrutiny over his role in a U.S. military strike on a suspected drug smuggling boat in the Caribbean. And now a new report says Hegseth risked a U.S. bombing mission in Yemen. You might recall back in March, it was discovered that he shared extremely sensitive attack plans on Signal, which is a publicly available messaging app. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie has been covering this and is here now. And before we get started, a note that NPR CEO Catherine Marr is the chair of the board for the Signal Foundation. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Juana.
So, Greg, just tell us about this new report. Where is it coming from?
Yeah, it's coming from the Pentagon's Inspector General, Stephen Stebbins. The report is expected to be released as early as tomorrow, and NPR hasn't seen it, but we have spoken to people who have. A source told NPR that the Inspector General concluded that Hegseth shared information clearly labeled secret, and this could have placed American forces in harm's way if an adversary had been able to see what he was sharing. And he was writing about a U.S. bombing campaign in Yemen just as it was about to begin in March. The report said Hegseth violated Pentagon policies by using a personal phone for office business. All this is coming from the source who wasn't authorized to speak publicly.
And how should they be handling a secretive mission like the one we're talking about here?
Yeah, Hegseth and other top national security officials have offices at work and at home where they can communicate securely on government systems known as SCIFs, Sensitive Compartmented Information Facilities. Signal, meanwhile, is a publicly available app. Anyone can download it. It does encrypt messages and is considered quite good, but not impenetrable, and government officials are still required to use government systems for sensitive information. Now, remember, all this became public because the officials organizing the Signal chat inadvertently included a journalist, Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, who was seeing all these messages in real time, and he refrained from reporting on them as they were appearing, but he eventually did so days later after the U.S. bombing campaign was well underway in Yemen.
And this was all a while ago, so if you could, just remind us what Hegseth's messages said about the Yemen campaign.
Yeah, he was sending messages in the hours and minutes even leading up to the U.S. start of the bombing campaign against the Houthis in Yemen. He provided the exact times that the U.S. was launching F-18 warplanes as well as drones and Tomahawk missiles. He also laid out the timeline when these weapons would begin to strike, information that's obviously very closely held when an operation is getting underway. And this operation against the Houthis lasted for weeks. It ultimately ended when the Houthi attacks diminished against those commercial ships in the Red Sea.
Greg, did Hegseth cooperate with this report?
Well, Hegseth would not sit for an interview with the investigators, though he did provide a written response. He provided only a few of his Signal messages. The inspector general had to rely mostly on screenshots that the journalist Jeffrey Goldberg published in The Atlantic. Hegseth denied any of the information he shared was classified. He said he was also able to declassify information, which is true. He can do that, but there was no indication that he did so before sharing the information. And Hegseth also told the investigators he believed it was a political investigation, and that, we should note many inspector generals are at government agencies, and they pride themselves in nonpartisan investigations.
Greg, last thing here. Are there likely to be any consequences for Hegseth here?
Well, the White House issued a statement saying this review affirms what the administration has said at the beginning. No classified information was leaked. So as long as President Trump wants to keep Hegseth as the Pentagon chief, he can stay in that role.
NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks as always.
Sure thing, Juana.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Emily Vinson. Emily was living in New Orleans in 2005 when Hurricane Katrina hit. In the aftermath, the city slowly recovered, but Emily's workplace had yet to reopen. So she got a new job at a pizza place. When she showed up her first day, she took her position behind the register. The shop was small, with pizza ovens to one side of her and the men prepping food directly behind her.
So, you know, I'd been there for maybe an hour. I really barely knew what my job was yet. I had had just arrived and I just fainted. And I came to, I'd hit my head on the counter and I came to laying on the floor of this pizza shop, and the guy making pizzas just stepped over me and opened the oven and pulled a pizza out of the oven. And almost immediately, one of the customers came behind the counter and scooped me up and took me outside and laid me on a picnic bench. My glasses had fallen off when I fainted, and I was bleeding from like where I'd hit kind of my eye area. And because the city was still in really just like this state of disarray, the first thing that happened was a Humvee of very young National Guardsmen came, and they didn't have any real proper medical kit, so they wrapped this huge bandage around my head. And this man, Randy, the one who had like scooped me up and taken me outside, throughout it all, he was sitting with me and kind of reassuring me and chatting with me. And he was like very offended on my behalf that this man had like pulled a pizza out of the oven before like attending to his employee who was like on the floor. The next thing I remember is the ambulance coming, and then I was taken away to the hospital after that. It's been 20 years now since the hurricane, but I think about him all the time, and just that he like, you know, he was just there for lunch. He wasn't planning on, you know, like tending to a young bleeding woman. So, you know, he immediately understood that something needed to happen and that no one else was going to do anything. And I think that's like an incredible ability and like impulse to like immediately jump in and help someone. And I don't know, that just always made like a really big impression on me, and it left an impact. I haven't really been in a lot of situations similar to this, but man, I hope that if I see something that I'll be that to somebody else, just to like hold their hand if they're feeling scared, or, you know, I can offer some reassurance or companionship for a short time. Like, I hope I'm able to be that for someone else.
That's Emily Vinson of Austin, Texas. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Your KQED traffic update at 6:18 starts with better news about the drive through the North Bay. Here's Julie Depish.
It just cleared a car and a pickup truck from the lanes on eastbound 37 to Skaggs Island Road. So they're gone now, but very tough back to Lakeville Highway. It's better news for the peninsula. Also, South 101 at Millbrae Avenue. Those three vehicles on the shoulder now, still backed up to South Airport. Have an overturned crash in San Jose and South 101 at Allen Rock. It'll be in the two left lanes. Traffic heavy all the way back to Guadalupe Parkway. Julie Depish for KQ.
Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, custom home builders. Support for KQED comes from Smuin's The Christmas Ballet. This joyful production features both classical ballet and contemporary numbers, with new additions premiering alongside audience favorites, now through December 28th. Tickets at smuinballet.org. From VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com.
From foot-chewing otters to Bay Bridge invading bunnies, Bay Area wildlife has been doing the absolute most this year. I'm Ray Alexandra from KQED's Arts and Culture Desk, and I spent much of 2025 monitoring the habits of local animals for hijinks, fluffy butts, and middle fingers at humanity. You can find my roundup at kqed.org/arts, where the Arts and Culture Desk also looks back at the year's best in film, music, books, and more.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word. Are you listening? Plastics. Next time on Marketplace. Think about it.
Stay with us for Marketplace coming up this evening at 6:30. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. From MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from the listeners of KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highland Sacramento, and live online at kqed.org. The time is 6:20.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Midterms are less than a year away, and election officials across the country say they are already preparing for the possibility of interference by the federal government led by President Trump. Joining me to talk through what those officials are watching for, NPR voting correspondent Miles Parks. Hey, Miles.
Hey there.
The context here is President Trump is still pushing falsehoods about the country's election systems. This is despite having won, fair and clear, the 2024 election. So what are officials watching for with the midterms?
So this is part of what's really challenging. No one really knows what to watch for. I was talking to one Secretary of State Democrat who told me it's a little like preparing for a natural disaster in that no one really knows what's coming. You have to prepare for the worst, but kind of hope for the best, basically. Mm-hmm. Luckily, voting officials have had to do a lot of that since 2020. That's something Carly Kappas told me. She's a Republican county clerk in Weld County, Colorado.
At this point, I think we're all just kind of used to, all right, what's the next crazy hairball thing that's going to pop up? I think we're all kind of conditioned at this point to expect anything and everything, and our bingo cards keep getting bigger and bigger.
Kappas said officials in her state are shoring up their relationships with local law enforcement and their county and state attorneys general's office. Any effort to interfere with voting, she told me, either from inside the government or outside the government, will meet a, quote, pretty good force of resistance.
Can we get specific? Like, what specifically are people like her preparing for?
So there are a couple scenarios that I've heard come up a lot. One is Trump, President Trump, attempting to expand his executive authority to control state or local rules or processes. States and counties do run their own elections. The Constitution basically gives the president no power over elections. But Trump has already tested that with an executive order in March that's mostly been blocked at this point by the courts. He has also been teasing another executive order, either targeting vote by mail or some sort of voting equipment. But the more alarming scenario to voting officials is a theory that's been pushed by some in the election denial space, that Trump could declare some sort of elections-related emergency to justify voting restrictions or changes to the process. Legal experts I've talked to, just to be clear, say there's no way he could actually usurp local authority this way, but it's something voting officials are talking about.
I'm so struck that there is something called the election denial space that we're talking about. Okay, we have also heard some Democrats warning about the possibility of National Guard troops being deployed to polling places. What are you hearing?
Yes. So this is something that after President Trump sent the National Guard to places like Portland this summer, it really crystallized it for election officials as something they need to prepare for. And I should note that Trump's former advisor, Steve Bannon, said on a podcast this year that he wanted to see immigration enforcement at polling places as well. Any of these scenarios would break federal voting laws. But when I reached out to the White House for comment on the possibility, they declined to rule out this scenario. They did refer to this scenario and a few of the other things I asked about as, quote, baseless conspiracy theories from Democrats.
Let's circle back to the fact that Trump himself still denies the 2020 election results, and he has brought into his second administration many people who agree with that, who feel similarly. What does that maybe mean for 2026?
I mean, first of all, it's going to make it harder for the average person to know where to get election information, right? I mean, voting officials for years have said, go to a trusted source for voting information. The definition of what that trusted source means is a little confusing right now. The Department of Homeland Security, for instance, probably should be considered a trusted source. And yet there are people in the Department of Homeland Security who have spread election conspiracy theories. Kate Conley oversaw election security issues under President Biden inside DHS's cyber agency, which is known as CISA. And she said she's been extremely troubled by what's happened at that agency. She's now running for Congress as a Democrat in New York.
If I were a state election official, I wouldn't be using CISA for services, which breaks my heart because we spend so much time building that trust and credibility and the apolitical nature of the service. And I don't trust it today.
And quickly, Miles, Trump administration officials, they're still investigating 2020.
They are. They've made unprecedented responses for requests for voting machines to access old ballots, to accumulate mass amounts of voter data, and election officials are expecting that to continue all the way up to midterms.
And Pierce Miles Parks, thank you.
Thank you.
The Trump administration wants to make it easier for car companies to sell gas guzzlers. The White House is proposing to reset federal fuel economy standards for new cars, removing an incentive to build EVs and cleaner gas cars. NPR's Camila Domonoske has been covering this, and she's here now. Hi.
Hi, Juana.
Camila, tell us about what the White House announced today.
Yeah, it's a proposal to make fuel efficiency standards a lot less strict. So these are rules called CAFE standards that cover all the vehicles an automaker sells in a year and requires that the average fuel economy get better. And the administration is calling for those requirements, instead of improving 2% every year, improving by 0.5% every year, much more gradual. Here's President Trump.
We're officially terminating Joe Biden's ridiculously burdensome, horrible, actually, CAFE standards that imposed expensive restrictions and all sorts of problems, gave all sorts of problems to automakers.
He was speaking at the Oval Office with the CEOs of Ford and Stellantis, the company behind Dodge and Jeep, a plant head from General Motors standing around him. You know, those same companies had executives who joined former President Joe Biden when he announced the current, much more ambitious version of these rules, which obviously fit with that past administration's focus on climate and reducing reliance on oil.
Now, this announcement, Camila, does it change anything immediately?
Well, no. And that's first because it's a proposal, that there's going to be a period of public comment before it becomes final, but also because Congress has already defanged these rules to the point of irrelevance. Part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act eliminated all fines for noncompliance with these standards, so rule breakers faced no consequences already. That said, the Trump administration argues that changing the rules would help this policy change stick. So even if Democrats come back in power, there would at least be a speed bump between changing them again.
So just on a practical level here, all of this, what does it mean for those of us who drive every day?
Yeah, well, the Trump administration frames this as a cost-saving maneuver, right? They are estimating that Americans could save more than $100 billion from vehicles being cheaper to buy up front because they don't need technologies that make them more efficient. Now, hybrids and electric vehicles do cost more to buy, but in the long run, they actually save owners money from buying less gasoline. Now, the president is totally correct when he argued this afternoon that affordability is a huge problem in the auto industry, with the average new car costing $50,000. The biggest factors driving that increase have been a semiconductor shortage and cars getting bigger and fancier. But another argument is that this is about consumer choice. Americans like big trucks and SUVs, so even though they're inefficient, this argument is that the government shouldn't be discouraging them.
Mm-hmm. And what about car companies?
Yeah, financially, this is a boost to them. Precisely because Americans like those big pickups, letting automakers make and sell more of them is very profitable. In fact, when I was listening to earnings calls this fall, a lot of executives called out these regulatory changes as real benefits to the bottom line that are helping offset the costs of tariffs. But there are two wrinkles here, one being that these companies operate globally. They have to navigate other countries where climate is still a priority, competition from Chinese EVs. So that's a reason to still invest in electric vehicles. And the second wrinkle is they have to plan years in advance. So whipsawing is not ideal, and I think everyone's prepared for the rules to potentially change again.
NPR's Camila Domonoske, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Your KQED traffic update at 6:29 includes the continuing trouble in San Jose. With the latest, here's Julie Deppish.
And it turned out to be a two-vehicle wreck, and one did overturn on South 101 at Alum Rock. Two left lanes still taken away. You're on the brakes into Mountain View. A couple cars got into it. Alamo, North 680 before Stone Valley Road. They're on the right shoulder, but look out for glass in the right lane. And up in San Rafael, North 101 at North San Pedro, a three-vehicle crash just clear from the middle lane. It looks better back to Central San Rafael. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Heath Ceramics. Heath's Make Good Market returns to San Francisco this weekend. Visitors can explore dozens of craft vendors along with food trucks from off the grid. Heath Ceramics, handcrafted in the Bay Area since 1948. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. It's 6:30.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance. Customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto. Learn more about bundling at progressive.com.
In which we go looking for the canary in the economic coal mine. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the United States Postal Service, offering holiday postage stamps for purchase at checkout at over 40,000 participating supermarkets and drugstores and at wholesale clubs Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, and BJ's. And by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by TreviPay, a fully managed B2B payments platform offering zero-touch AR, smart invoicing options, and tools designed to reduce DSO so businesses can spend less time chasing payments. More at TreviPay.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the third day of December. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. We are agreed, are we not, that the labor market is the whole deal right now, yes? Sure, inflation, but people working in this economy are uneasy about their prospects. Companies are adding fewer jobs, and the Federal Reserve, as you know, has made clear its heightened interest. Also, and not for nothing, we're a couple of months behind on actually measuring the American job market. So, of necessity, as we have talked about, private data is playing a more important role. To wit, the private payroll processing company ADP told us this morning that by its count, this economy, net-net, lost 32,000 jobs last month. For small businesses, though, that's companies with less than 50 employees, they lost 120,000 jobs. What, you ask, might we learn from that? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the answer.
Anna Hammond is CEO of Matriarch Foods, which employs four people. They take surplus crops and byproducts and turn them into finished food, like pasta sauce and even meal kits for emergencies. I asked her, how is business?
Things are okay, actually.
She's even considering adding more employees. Tariffs haven't been an issue for Matriarch.
All of the vegetables are U.S. grown.
Inflation, they've mostly dodged.
Because we work with byproducts and surplus, you know, our costs are less.
But Hammond can sense a change in buyers.
People being much, much, much more careful with the dollars that they're spending.
Still, for now, Hammond is optimistic, as are many small business owners, according to surveys by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
The small business economy is holding steady.
Tom Sullivan is Senior Vice President for Small Business Policy at the Chamber.
Confidence in their businesses and their abilities to succeed continues to be heightened.
But here, too, it is a mixed bag.
We are seeing a decrease in plans to reinvest in business, and that scares us, quite frankly.
The National Federation of Independent Business Research Center also surveys small businesses. It also found a mixed bag. Service businesses, for example, have slowed down on hiring people, but construction can't find enough people.
Which, in combination, you're not looking at a lot of job growth.
Holly Wade is executive director at the Research Center. But so often, in business as in life, what people say they feel is different from what they do. A company called Homebase runs payroll for 150,000 small businesses and has real-time data on what they are actually doing around hiring.
From our vantage point, small businesses are absolutely pulling back on hiring and hours worked in a way we haven't seen the last 3 years.
John Waldman is CEO of Homebase.
Small businesses are leading indicators of what our medium and larger business is going to do later.
He says a lot is going to hinge on how well this holiday shopping season goes. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, here's the logic. A weaker job market, see also that ADP number, means the Fed is all but certain to cut rates when it meets next week. Classic trader bad news is actually good news thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back in the day, it was called layaway, but it's gotten a rebrand. Buy now, pay later, BNPL for short, is booming. You make a payment up front, maybe 25% of the full purchase price, regular payments thereafter, generally without interest. And there is lots of consumer interest, if I may say. BNPL topped $1 billion for the first time this past Cyber Monday, up more than 4% over a year ago. It's offered, usually, at checkout by payment providers like Klarna and Affirm and PayPal, also by retailers themselves. Makes sense for consumers, obviously. You get your thing before you've paid for the whole thing. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, there is a business model side to this thing, too.
Buy now, pay later is a pretty good deal for consumers. You get the goods you want right away, but you're only out a fraction of the price. You can spread the payments out for when future paychecks are coming in. There usually aren't fees, and the debt doesn't grow with interest. Here's Duke business professor Manju Puri.
How does this work? Because the consumer is getting zero interest loan. We know there's supposed to be no free lunch in finance, so someone is paying for this. Who's paying for it and why?
The answer, both the retailer and the payment provider have skin in this game. Retailers pay a fee to the payment provider on each transaction, explains Grace Broadbent at eMarketer.
Buy now, pay later fees range between 2 to 8% of the sales cost. And that is compared to credit card processing fees, which are from like 1.5 to 3.5%.
That's a hefty bite taken out of a retailer's profit margin. Why would they do it?
So buy now, pay later can help them improve their conversion rates at checkout.
That means fewer consumers leave abandoned shopping carts on retailers' websites full of stuff they kinda want but don't think they can afford. If it's only going to cost $20 now, not the full $100, maybe they can afford it after all. Also, merchants end up selling more to each consumer on their site. And keep in mind, the retailer gets paid up front in full for whatever they've sold, says Ed DeHaan at the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
So from the retailer's perspective, they're not bearing any risk because the money is being paid by the BNPL provider. Then you have to say, well, who's making money here? Well, on the BNPL provider's side, they're getting a cut of fees from the retailer. So that's a primary source of revenue.
Plus, says DeHaan,
they also get paid for things like data. They harvest an enormous amount of data on their customers. They can offer highly tailored advertising.
The payment providers do absorb all the credit risk, that the consumer won't pay back the loan and they'll be out the money they fronted to the retailer. But so far, says DeHaan, default rates on BNPL loans haven't been notably high. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I feel pretty comfortable saying that the odds of you having touched, used, or otherwise interacted with plastic today, and every day really, are just about 100%. We are surrounded by it. More and more of it is produced every year, and in fact, annual production is expected to triple by the year 2060. The issues with plastic for us, people, and for the planet are well known. So what's an economy to do? Judith Enck is a former regional administrator for the EPA. She now works with the advocacy group Beyond Plastic, and her new book on the subject at hand is called The Problem with Plastic. Welcome to the program.
Thrilled to be with you.
I was struck to read in the opening pages of this book, actually, that half of all the plastic we have on this planet right now has been created since like 2007 or something.
Yeah, this is a recent serious problem. I mean, plastic really hit the market after World War II, but this massive increase is relatively recent, which says to me, we can solve the problem. It's a new problem, and we know that there are alternatives.
So let's talk about the solving the problem, which is fundamentally what this book is about. You point out, and after you said it, I was like, yes, of course, plastics are known to be an environmental nightmare. They are known to be, in some cases, toxic. And yet we don't regulate it like we do, say, lead or asbestos. And I guess the question is why? And I want your answer to go beyond big oil has really powerful lobbying arms.
Well, big oil has really powerful lobbying arms. That is actually the major problem. I mean, I used to work at the EPA. I was a regional administrator during the Obama administration. And even then, there was not much of a focus on plastic. But today, there are many good proposals around the world to deal with plastics. It's not a science issue. It really is a political science issue. The enormous political strength of chemical companies, fossil fuel companies, and consumer brand companies are what's standing in the way of protecting our health and our environment.
We do have to say, though, that for all of those things, which are true that you just pointed out, consumers wanting ease and facility and low prices is part of the challenge.
Well, I think the bigger problem is consumers don't have a choice. And we can have ease and affordability and not have plastic. We don't need to wait for a big space age breakthrough. We can rely on paper, cardboard, metal, glass. They can all be made from recycled material and actually do get recycled when you put it in the recycling bin, and not substantially more expensive than plastic.
Let's just take a very quick detour here to trod some conceivably well-trod ground, certainly on public radio, but it needs to be said. We put all this plastic in our blue recycling bins and put them out by the curb, but there the recycling myth kind of ends, yes?
Yeah, putting plastics into your recycling bin does not mean it gets recycled. Only 5 to 6% of plastics actually get recycled. It's not because we're not all trying. It's because by design, most plastics are not recyclable. And the reason why many of us are confused is because the plastics industry has spent millions of dollars telling us just keep recycling your single-use plastic. Mm-hmm. It's so bad, in fact, that Attorney General of California, Rob Bonta, has sued ExxonMobil for deceptive statements around plastics recycling.
So let's do a little solutions journalism here. You spoke earlier about some great solutions around the world. Give me your top, like, three ways that we, specifically in the United States, rather, because that's the test audience here. What can we do?
Oh, there's so much.
Okay, you got three.
Okay. I think we need to pass new laws to make sure that the producers of plastic actually pay for disposal. I think we need to shift toward reusable and refillable packaging. When I was growing up, and I'm not that old, we had milk in refillable glass bottles. We need to build that refill reuse infrastructure, but it starts with getting new laws on the book so that the plastics producers don't continue to have a free ride.
Judith Enck is most recently the author of a book called The Problem with Plastic. Judith, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
September last year, Hurricane Helene tore through parts of Florida, Georgia, and North Carolina. For those who didn't live through it, it feels like a long time ago. But for the communities that were hardest hit, things are just now getting back to normal. And that's especially the case for small businesses that are gearing up for their first holiday retail season in 2 years. Hannah Berniski owns one of them. It's called Cold Mountain Art Collective. It's a pottery and art gallery and studio in Canton, North Carolina.
Business has been really good. The studio has been really busy. We've picked up a couple new memberships. Our classes have been full. I did make some really conscious choices to, in the new year, I'll be dissolving this gallery side, like our larger retail side, and opening up working studios instead, because it will give me more free time. I could be building my own brand and accepting opportunities as an artist that I feel like I've been missing out lately. Holiday shopping has definitely started. So there's increased foot traffic in the gallery doing holiday shopping and supporting local. I think since we've made the announcement too that we'll be dissolving the gallery after the new year, people are coming in to really show support for the final time with these artists and this work that they might not see again. I've been creating a lot of my staples. My Blue Ridge Mountain pieces are my best seller. I can't keep them in stock. They're $52 for the mugs, I think $48 for the bowls. But they are great gifts, and that's what a lot of people are buying them for. They're like, oh, I already have my two, but I want to get some for my sister. And so they're repeat buyers, which is what I love. In comparison to what I've been through in the last year, things are just going really well, and I'm just so grateful to be back, to be in this space. I think it was last year a woman came in, her name is Hazel, and she told me she met her husband in my building back when it was an ice cream parlor. She came back in a couple weeks ago just to see how we were doing, and she was so glad we were back, and it was just really nice to see her again because, you know, we don't know what happens to people, especially over the last year where everybody went, if they stayed in town or left, and it was just really nice to see her and talk to her again.
Hannah Berniski, she's the owner of Cold Mountain Art Collective. It's in Canton, North Carolina. Coming up,
you'd set an overall cap on the number of meals out.
Why would you want to do that? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 408 points. That is 0.9%, 47,882 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ ticked up 40 points, about 0.2%, 23,454. The S&P 500 added 20 points, a third of 1%, 6849 are there. In another sign that Americans are spending away this holiday season, the country's biggest department store chain, Macy's, raised its outlook for sales. Today, the company reported its strongest growth in more than 3 years. That comes after the company shifted strategies, closing 150 stores. Macy's down 0.1% because capitalism. Delta says the government shutdown this fall cost it roughly 200 million American simoleons. Bookings were down 5-10% over the 10 days when it was forced to make flight reductions. Things are back to normal now, though. Delta climbed 3.6%. American Airlines rose 2.25%. United jumped 3.9%. Bonds up, yields down. 10 years at 4.06%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Viking, dedicated to bringing travelers to the heart of each destination with small ship, river, ocean, and expedition voyages, offering cultural enrichment and immersive experiences. Discover more at Viking.com. And by Wealth Enhancement, offering its Wealth Blueprint plan through advisors nationwide. It integrates retirement, investing, taxes, and more into one plan. Learn more at wealthenhancement.com/build. And by JumpCloud, simplifying IT through its intelligent, unified AI-backed platform that securely connects users to any resource from any device anywhere. JumpCloud, helping organizations prepare for AI acceleration.
Thank you.
Support for KQED comes from BART, helping to make holiday travel easier with just one quick tap of any bank card. Riders can be on their way to SFO or OAK to start their holiday adventures. More ways to pay at BART.gov/tap and ride. And from Rising Team, creator of Supermanager AI, giving leaders at all levels a leadership personal trainer and coaching partner to help build essential skills, practice hard conversations, and strengthen team performance. Learn more at supermanager.ai. 6:49, I'm Michelle Hennigan. Julie Deppisch will be here with your traffic update after Marketplace. And then at 7 o'clock on Fresh Air, Washington Post reporter Alex Horton discusses President Trump's military strikes on alleged Venezuelan narco-terrorists. Horton broke the story about a second strike to kill two survivors of a targeted boat in compliance with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's order to kill the entire crew. That's on Fresh Air coming up at 7 on KQED News.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Time now for another trip in the government economic data time machine, courtesy of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, whence came today something called the Import Price Index for 3 months ago, September. The big headline? Overall import prices, that is, what U.S. importers paid for everything from fuel to manufacturing equipment, alcoholic beverages to apparel, and this is important, that's before taxes, were essentially unchanged. But as Marketplace's Carla Javier explains, things get a little more interesting once you look a little closer and once you start to factor in those import taxes, too.
Susan Fleck's team at BLS knocks on doors and asks companies the prices they paid for imports. Then they bring in millions of prices from Customs and the Department of Commerce.
Then when you add up which prices have changed for which product areas, and there's addition and multiplication, I would say, and quite a bit of it, and some logarithms, then what you get at the very top level is that it appears there's no change.
Until you look at the lower levels. If you take out fuel, for example, because fuel prices can be quite variable, the index went up. KPMG's Megan Schoenberger says she likes to look for categories where prices decreased.
It insulates both the importer in terms of their profit margins and the final consumer from price increases when import prices come down.
She noticed prices came down for computers, electronics, and European wine, but not in all categories.
We do see that import prices fall, generally speaking, in response to tariffs. That hasn't happened as much this time.
Decreases in some categories were offset with increases in others, including non-fuel industrial supplies and materials.
U.S. importers of steel and aluminum and other metals from the European Union are actually paying more than what they were a few months ago.
That's Jason Miller at Michigan State University. When you factor tariffs in, he says,
that means they're paying a whole heck of a lot more for these products.
Which puts manufacturers in a difficult spot.
Do we not expand our production lines like we were thinking because machinery is more expensive? Do we maybe buy fewer tools than we were planning? Do we maybe buy more tools but actually look at cutting our workforce?
Miller says he wonders if manufacturers will absorb any increased costs through lower margins or pass them along to their buyers. I'm Carla Javier from Marketplace.
This is, to understate it just a little tiny bit, a very bad time for federal policies that address climate change. See also the president's announcement today that he's cutting vehicle fuel emission standards, and with Republicans in Congress, he has gotten rid of a lot of Biden-era clean energy grants and tax credits. But the feds ain't the only game in town. States, some of them anyway, are trying to cut carbon emissions. On the East Coast, that includes an agreement among a group of 10 states to reduce the amount of CO2 coming out of power plants. It's been going for 16 years, that agreement has. It has mostly worked out all right. But as Marketplace's Henry App reminds us, it is a memento of a bygone time.
Imagine a world where both major presidential candidates agree that climate change is a serious problem, and they want to use the same policy to address it. This was a real thing in 2008.
I think a cap-and-trade system makes more sense. That's why I proposed it.
When our cap-and-trade policy is in place, there will be a sudden and sustained pursuit in the market for new investment opportunities in low-emission fuel sources.
Republican John McCain and Democrat Barack Obama disagreed on some details, but they agreed that a national cap-and-trade system could push power plants and other industries in the U.S. to lower their carbon emissions. Spoiler alert, their proposals never made it through Congress. But shortly after the 2008 election, 10 states on the East Coast started a cap-and-trade system of their own, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI. Unless you're very steeped in energy policy, you're forgiven for not remembering how cap-and-trade works. Peter Shattuck at the energy consulting firm Power Advisory has an analogy for REGGI.
Let's say for whatever reason we wanted to reduce the amount of dining out. You'd set an overall cap on the number of meals out
and sell passes to people who want to eat at restaurants. But the total number of passes available would go down over time. So wannabe diners would bid up the price for them, supply and demand.
It would create an incentive to do other things like eat at home. And if you reuse the revenue raised by selling the passes and stocking people's kitchens, then it would be all the more appealing to eat at home and we'd reduce the amount of dining out.
This, but for carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. That's what REGGI does. Owners of fossil fuel plants in REGGI states have to buy a permit to emit 1 ton of CO2. The total number of permits available declines over time, so they're incentivized to switch to forms of energy that don't emit carbon. And the money they pay for permits goes back to states. Again, Peter Shattuck.
The revenue raised by selling those permits to pollute are reinvested in things like energy efficiency that further bring down demand and reduce pollution.
16 years in, it's worked pretty well. Carbon emissions from electricity generation in the REGGI states have dropped significantly, says REGGI's executive director, Andrew McKeon.
If we're looking at all the states that participated in REGGI from 2009 to the present, we're looking at about a 53% reduction through 2024.
But REGGI can't take all the credit for that.
It's important to remember that REGGI launched right at the same time as the fracking revolution came about.
Sam Evans-Brown is the executive director at Clean Energy New Hampshire. Fracking made natural gas really cheap. Natural gas also emits less carbon than coal or oil. So as power companies switched to gas, they suddenly didn't need nearly as many carbon permits as the states in REGGI expected. So REGGI states pushed down the cap even more. And eventually, the price of their carbon permits rose by about 10 times. Evans-Brown says that could have an impact.
This could be the time that REGGI is starting to become a price signal that will be meaningful enough that it'll drive new renewable generation onto the grid.
But that price signal, putting an extra cost on energy sources that emit carbon dioxide, is also what's made REGGI a political target. Danny Cullen-Ward is with the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania.
Carbon pricing makes the cost of compliance visible, makes it easy for opponents to organize against those policies.
Which has always made cap and trade a hard sell. I'm Henry App for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Solidigm. Today's AI ambitions require a different approach to storage. Solidigm offers solid-state storage solutions optimized for AI with higher capacities, greater speed, and energy efficiency. StorageForAI.com. And by the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to raising awareness and accelerating action on America's fiscal challenges to build a brighter economic future for the next generation. Learn more at pgpf.org.
This final note on the way out today, just because it's been a little bit, gold, the safest of all safe havens, still firmly above $4,000 an ounce. Make of that what you will. Just remember that gold is where people go when there's a lot of economic agita. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, John Fokey, Montana Johnson, Drew Jostet, Gary O'Keefe, Alex Simpson, in Charlton Thorpe. Jeff Peters is the manager of media production. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This right here is APM.
Missed Giving News Day? You can still get your gift matched. Arthur and Tony Remby Rock are extending their dollar-for-dollar match up to $20,000 until midnight tonight. Help KQED turn up the volume on our services by donating now at kqed.org/donate. Fresh Air is coming up after a look at traffic starting in San Jose. Here's Julie Deppish.
Yeah, they're still trying to clear that wreck. South 101 at Allen Rocks has been blocking the two left lanes. You're back up all the way to Lawrence Expressway. Another South Bay crash westbound 237 at Zanker Road. A couple vehicles here in the two right lanes. Look out for the stall in Walnut Creek and North 680 at Olympic, blocking the right lane a little slow from Stone Valley Road. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity.